I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome to Fronteras, a show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. As the Trump administration cracks down on illegal immigration, people who've lived undocumented in the U.S. for years are at risk of deportation. Some of them are seeking shelter in religious congregations. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement mostly stays away from so-called sensitive locations like churches and other places of worship. But what is it actually like to live in a state of limbo inside a congregation? For the past 10 months, Jorge Taborda has lived at Holy Cross Retreat Center in Mesilla Park, New Mexico. He's there with his 16-year-old son, who's a U.S. citizen, along with another family also sheltering there. Taborda came to the center when his wife and older son were detained. His wife was eventually deported back to their native Colombia. Fronteras correspondent Mallory Falk brings us their story.
Jorge Taborda is a longtime Red Cross volunteer. He served hot food from the back of a truck after Hurricane Katrina. He went door to door handing out cleaning supplies after a flood in central Texas. He even won an award for Disaster Volunteer of the Year. But last summer, when Hurricane Harvey struck, Taborda couldn't help out.
I wanted to work when the hurricane hit. That's my life, ayudando a la gente.
Instead, he was stuck inside the Holy Cross Retreat Center, where he's been living for the past 10 months trying to avoid deportation.
Okay. Is it the back here?
Taborda wants to be useful wherever he is, so a few days a week he helps clean the guest rooms.
It's a good responsibility to pay for the hospitality. I don't want to be a charge for my stay here.
He opens the door to a small, tidy room with twin beds and red carpet, plugs in the vacuum, and gets to work. Taborda lived in the U.S. without a problem for almost 20 years. He settled in Las Cruces, New Mexico, with his wife Francia and their two sons, Jefferson, who has protection under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, and Stephen, who was born here. Taborda, who was a literature professor in Colombia, found work as a computer technician. But all that changed on May 9th.
Esto fue hasta el día en que todo se nos vino encima.
That was the day everything came down on us. The whole world came down on us.
Federal agents detained Taborda's wife and older son, seemingly out of nowhere. They came after him too, but he managed to make it to a church and from there to the retreat center.
Nunca llegamos a imaginarnos llegaría a
tocar. I never imagined this situation could come knocking at our door.
ICE eventually released Jefferson, but they deported Francia.
Yo sentí que toda una vida de trabajo, esperanzas, ilusiones.
I felt like an entire life of work, hopes, everything came down on me. They destroyed everything we'd built for more than 18 years.
Taborda wants to apply for a stay of removal, but he has to do that in person. ICE says he can't send a lawyer on his behalf, and he's afraid he'll get detained. So he's living at the center in a state of limbo, keeping himself busy with chores. Father Tom Smith is director of the Holy Cross Retreat Center.
I, as a Catholic priest and as a Franciscan, think that we need to not only pray for people and to advocate for them, I think sometimes we need to offer direct support.
Smith was ready when he got the call about Taborda. A few months earlier, he'd talked things over with the local diocese and decided if the need arose, he would offer shelter. There wasn't much to prepare.
As a retreat center, we have lots of rooms and we have a kitchen staff and cleaning staff and all that kind of stuff already here. So it was just dedicating some space to them, a couple rooms to them.
The center itself is beautiful, surrounded by acres of pecan trees. There's a large courtyard, a big adobe chapel, a clear view of the Oregon Mountains. Smith was clear with Taborda about what exactly he could offer.
We don't call it sanctuary. We call it Franciscan hospitality, because I think the word sanctuary is a little bit misleading. It presumes that it's, quote, safe.
Smith wrote a letter to the local ICE field office letting them know he was hosting Taborda. He'd consulted several lawyers who counsel congregations, and that's what they advised, so he wouldn't get arrested for harboring a fugitive. If agents show up with a search warrant, Smith can't actually stop them. He's banking on the fact that it's ICE policy to generally avoid sensitive locations like hospitals, schools, and places of worship.
So at this point, he's been here since May, and there's been no problem.
Un poquito más. Yeah.
Listo.
Yeah.
After chores, Taborda usually makes something to eat. There's a small kitchen in his living quarters, but sometimes he prefers the main kitchen. It has an industrial stovetop, perfect for making arepas. Taborda mixes corn powder and shredded cheese in a small bowl.
And this is okay. That's the egg.
Taborda can't go grocery shopping, so he depends on volunteers. He sends them a list with staples like eggs and milk, plus a special kind of pulp to make his favorite Colombian drink. Taborda usually pays them back, but sometimes they refuse his money. He's grateful for their help, calls them his angels, but it's been hard to rely on others.
Yo siento mucha vergüenza.
I felt a lot of shame, a lot of pain, because I'm depending on the goodwill of so many people.
Taborda pauses, overcome with emotion.
Que no puedo trabajar para nuestros gastos.
I can't work to pay for my family's expenses.
He's still earning some money repairing computers. People drop them off at the retreat center. But it isn't nearly as much as he made before, and it's been almost impossible for his wife to find work in Colombia. So they're financially strained.
Ahí está el molde, ya lista. Ya está lista.
Taborda pushes these thoughts aside to focus on the task at hand.
Acá. Ahí está.
He plops the arepas on the stove and smiles as they sizzle. The sanctuary movement got its start back in the 1980s at a church in Tucson.
My name is John Fife. I was pastor of Southside Presbyterian Church in the 1980s when we were the first congregation in the nation to declare sanctuary for Central American refugees.
Originally, Fife says, the idea was to start a legal aid organization to help those refugees win asylum.
And it took us about a year to understand that was an exercise in futility.
Because the government wouldn't grant asylum to people from El Salvador and Guatemala, which were U.S. allies in the Cold War.
So then the question became, well, if that's not going to provide protection for refugees from deportation to death squads and massacres, what do we have to do? And so we reached back for the ancient tradition of the church and faith communities as sanctuaries, which is a biblical tradition that flows through centuries of the church protecting people who are fleeing for their lives.
The sanctuary movement looked different back then. Fife was working with people who'd just crossed the border. Some of them were in really bad shape after long and dangerous journeys. So Fife found them medical care, then helped send them on to churches in other states far away from the border, in a system he says was modeled on the Underground Railroad. Now a lot of people seeking shelter are like Jorge Taborda. They've lived in the U.S. for years, even decades. They have children who were born here. Fife is hopeful for them.
We demonstrated in the 1980s that faith communities are capable of protecting vulnerable people whose lives are threatened by capture and detention and deportation. We were able to do that until the government was forced to change its policy.
The U.S. eventually gave those refugees temporary protected status. Some went on to become citizens. That's the kind of change Jorge Taborda would like to see now.
Nos gustaría ver que los políticos se comprometieran.
We would like to see politicians commit themselves more to the right of the family, to respect the rights of so many North American children, and to begin to make and promote laws that can fix the situation.
Taborda says under God's law, only death separates families.
Es como que estén imponiéndonos pena de muerte.
It's like they're imposing the death penalty on us, because we don't know if we will ever find ourselves together as a family again.
For now, Taborda stays in touch with his wife Francia through WhatsApp. Today he calls her up on video chat to share her experience. She peers through the screen, brown hair pulled back, and immediately mentions her 16-year-old son.
Todavía tenemos un niño adolescente.
We still have a child who needs us, she says. He's at a crucial point in his life, and this is disrupting his trajectory. Luckily, she says, her husband is able to stay with their son. Otherwise, he could have ended up with a family they didn't know who might not raise him right. She says, I understand that being here without documents meant we were breaking a law, but they are breaking a more important law, the law saying a family should be united. Taborda and his wife exchange a few words and promise to talk again soon.
Besitos, pues. Bueno. Bye.
By now it's late afternoon, time for Stephen to get back from school. Taborda steps outside to wait. Soon, a truck comes rumbling up the long drive leading to the retreat center. Stephen hops out of the truck. He's got his backpack slung over one shoulder and a chemistry book under his arm. He races inside to put down his stuff. Roger Beck is one of several volunteers who drive Stephen to and from school now that Taborda can't.
Through the church, I really learned about this case. And I said to myself, this is something I can do. I'm retired. Something I can do.
Back inside the retreat center, Stephen sits down for an early dinner of yellow rice and teriyaki chicken. He's a studious kid who likes to learn about business and self-improvement. His dream? Build a billion-dollar candy company specializing in flavored marshmallows.
So when I have a $1 billion company, I would assume that I would have about $100 million as my personal money. So I would just help my family in Colombia and give to charity.
Stephen remembers that chaotic day when federal agents came for his parents.
I was just kind of like, what am I going to do in the future? Like, what if my parents are gone? Am I going to stay with my brother or am I going to a foster family?
He's relieved he can stay with his dad, but says the situation isn't fair.
We did pretty much everything a citizen would do, like pay taxes, follow laws, but we weren't really treated as well.
After dinner, Stephen and his dad will likely fall into their usual routine. Stephen does homework, Taborda tinkers with somebody's broken computer. This is how they're living, day by day, focused on the tasks in front of them. But everyone desperately hopes this is temporary, that soon their family will be reunited and things can go back to normal. In Mesilla Park, I'm Mallory Falk.
Coming up on Fronteras, an immigration attorney says laws cracking down on illegal immigration are not going to make a difference to people whose lives are in danger.
The journey from Africa or South America or Central America to the U.S. is extremely dangerous. There is no parent who's going to take a child on that journey unless they think it's absolutely necessary.
That's coming up after this break. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. The laws surrounding sanctuary and immigration have changed vastly from administration to administration in the 20th and 21st century. Undocumented immigrants have been living in fear and uncertainty because of the ever-fluctuating nature of immigration law. Erica Schomer is an immigration attorney and clinical assistant professor at St. Mary's University School of Law in San Antonio. Her experience providing legal assistance to undocumented immigrants goes back to working with Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid, a nonprofit that provides free legal services to Southwest Texas residents who can't afford a lawyer. She told us about one memorable case while working at TRALA.
I represented a man who actually was a U.S. citizen. But didn't know it. His father was a U.S. citizen born in the U.S. He had been brought to the U.S., to the Rio Grande Valley, when he was a baby. Grown up, you know, his whole life, never lived in Mexico, didn't really have any family there. He was a green card holder, and he had a criminal conviction, which got him into trouble with immigration. And when I looked at his case, I said, I think you're actually a U.S. citizen based on time that your dad lived in the U.S. But the problem was that by then his father was dead. His parents had never, had a relationship. They never lived together. And so it took quite a while to track down the information. And when we, presented the evidence to the judge didn't think it was enough evidence. And so the case went up on appeal. In all, he ended up being detained, I think, almost 2 years before we actually got a decision from the agency confirming that he was a U.S. citizen. And so, that was a case that was really difficult, but ultimately we did prevail.
I'm sure the time that you've been practicing, you've seen changes in immigration law over the years, and almost with every administration, there are a number of changes, and we've seen a big immigration crackdown with the current administration. And one of the sort of new elements we're seeing arise is this separation of families. What do you see when it comes to that type of policy in your practice?
Sure. Well, I think, one, since 2014, there really are more families coming together. So entire families, sometimes it's mom, dad, and children, certainly a lot of moms with children. And before 2014, most of those family units were simply kind of processed at the border and released to pursue their cases. When the prior administration built the family detention centers that are close to San Antonio, the 2,000-bed facility in Dilley and the 700-bed facility in Karnes City for women and children, that really changed the game, where you saw, you know, family units being detained on a large scale. Now we're hearing more and more about families who are separated at the border, where, you know, parent is being sent to one detention center, child is being sent to another detention center. They could be separated by thousands of miles, and it really creates a lot of issues in pursuing their legal case. And then, of course, there's the humanitarian issues about, you know, separating children from their parents, especially when most of these families are coming because they're fleeing persecution. They've already suffered some kind of harm. So then you put that separation on top of it, and it's extremely traumatic to the individuals.
So this policy of family separation, have you seen it making any difference at all in the numbers of families that are coming into the United States?
No. I think there's an idea by the administration that detention itself or separating families is going to have a deterrent effect, but the reality just doesn't match up. People are coming because their lives are in danger. The journey from, you know, Africa or South America or Central America to the U.S. is extremely dangerous. There is no parent who's going to take a child on that journey unless they think it's absolutely necessary. This is not something that people do because they think, oh, I'd like to see a different place and earn a little bit more money, so I think we're going to pack up and cross a desert and take 10 buses and put our lives in the hands of a smuggler just for something to do.
And so immigration law, again, is just constantly evolving. And just recently we heard about the U.S. Supreme Court's declaring that legal immigrants and undocumented immigrants who are imprisoned really don't have any right to bond or bail. How has that recently affected you and your practice?
It's a really unfortunate decision. Unfortunately, here in San Antonio and in this area, that decision doesn't change anything, because the Supreme Court took up that case because there was a circuit split. There were some circuits that were saying, yes, mandatory detention is okay up until a point, but at 6 months, there's a liberty interest at stake. So after 6 months, everybody's entitled to a bond hearing where the government has to produce evidence that a person's either a danger or a flight risk. So some circuits were giving people bond hearings every 6 months. The Fifth Circuit, where we are, had not followed that line of reasoning. And so for people detained, for example, in Pearsall at the South Texas Detention Center, unfortunately, if they were subject to what's called mandatory detention, where a judge doesn't have jurisdiction to give a bond, it didn't matter. They weren't getting bond hearings anyway. Of course, I hoped that the Supreme Court was going to come out differently so that people in the Fifth Circuit and in the other circuits that hadn't adopted that reasoning would be able to get bond hearings at the six-month mark, but that's not how it came out now, although the case is going to go back to look at the issue of whether or not the statute is constitutional. So there is, you know, still a chance that it could come out right, but it's going to take a while, and now it means that a lot more people are going to be in detention for longer periods of time.
And that detention could be indefinite, correct?
There certainly are cases that take years. So the case that I spoke to you about at Trala of a U.S. citizen, like at that point in my career, that was a client who I represented who was detained for the longest period of time. You know, interestingly, when it was all done and he was free, he told me, if I had known in the beginning that it was going to take this long, I wouldn't have done it. And that just kind of made my heart break, because there's someone who it came out the right way for. But the detention was so hard on him and so hard on his family that, you know, a lot of people end up giving up. And that is, you know, one of the things that is really, from a perspective of looking at justice, is really unfair, that you have a person who has a legitimate claim, but it can just take a long time to get that claim adjudicated depending on what the case is like. And detention shouldn't be used as a weapon to make people with viable claims be in the situation where they feel like they have to give up.
Erica Schomer is an immigration attorney and clinical assistant professor at St. Mary's University School of Law in San Antonio. Thanks for joining us this week for Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Norma Martinez and Jerry Quijano produced the broadcast. Our executive producers are Steve Short and Fernando Ortiz. Our digital editor is Vince Kong. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.